This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking to three of the nominees for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards in the nonfiction category. There are a few you won't hear today. They are Robert Blamire, who wrote Birch Bayh, Making a Difference. We spoke to him last fall. Ross Gay, author of The Book of Delights. And Axton Betts Hamilton, who wrote The Less People Know About Us, A Mystery of Betrayal, Family Secrets, and Stolen Identity. We talked to her in December. The first author we'll hear from today wrote Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. This interview first aired in November of last year. The question of nature versus nurture and what makes us who we are has been debated for ages. Professor of Microbiology at Indiana University School of Medicine, Bill Sullivan, might have some answers. He joins us now to talk about his book, Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Matt. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Your book explores how our personalities and actions are shaped by our DNA. And I think many of us like to think that we're in the driver's seat when we're making our daily decisions. But how much does DNA actually come into play here?
That's a really good question. And like you said, it's been debated for ages ever since the notion that genes could start control things beyond our physical traits. So the research into my book, Pleased to Meet Me, uncovered several hidden forces, actually. In addition to our genes, there's this new science called epigenetics, which involves the environment and how it acts on our genes. And there's also these microbes that we carry around in our gut, especially, that can also affect brain chemistry and a number of things about our personality. The key thing I realized going through the research of this book is that our genes govern a lot more than just our hair color or eye color, but they have far-reaching effects into our personality traits and our behavior.
You found that when we understand the impact that our genes have on our lives, it starts to help us better understand patterns of behavior. Addiction, for instance. Can you explain how genes can play a role in addiction?
This is really surprising. So addiction was long thought to be just an issue of self-discipline or self-control, willpower. And we're not saying that that's not true, but there are definitely genes that can strongly pull you towards an addictive personality. And that science is very well established now, some of which, especially for alcoholism, took place right here at the IU School of Medicine, some of the pioneering studies. So people are finding that there's a number of genes associated with alcoholism in particular. Ozzy Osbourne, in fact, had his genome sequenced about 10 years ago. Scientists actively sought him out as a participant in their genomic study because they knew he had a lifetime of partying and he struggled with alcohol and drug addiction all of his life. And they were wondering, how is this guy still alive? How is he still going at 70 years? And it turns out he had a number of variations within his genome that are speculated to have made him better at detoxifying alcohol. And there's also gene networks that they found that set him up to be predisposed towards alcohol, which actually are characteristics that many people who struggle with alcohol use disorder also have those same variations.
This is exciting for me. Let's talk about another trait, like overeating. That was also a behavior linked to our DNA. Can information like this help someone change patterns in behavior, or is it beyond our control?
It certainly can. And obesity is actually a very complex disease. There are a multitude of different genes that are being implicated in the process, and it affects how we treat the disease and how we go about solving the problem. So what affects about 10 to 15% of morbidly obese individuals could be a genetic variation in the system that tells our brain how hungry we are. So this is controlled by hormonal signals. As we eat, our stomach and fat cells start to produce a hormone called leptin, and it travels to our brain and says, hey, brain, we're full. You can stop eating now. And then as time goes by, the body starts to secrete ghrelin, which is telling the brain that, hey, your stomach's empty, it's time to eat again. So this is a very elegant little system, and it's just one of several that are that have been found in the body. And if someone is born with a mutation in any part of that system, in the making of this hormone leptin or in the receptor of the brain that binds to it, it can disrupt appetite. So in other words, if people have a leptin deficiency, their brain never gets the signal that they've had enough to eat. So they tend to overeat at every meal and at every snack, and this is what ultimately leads to weight gain. The nail in the coffin, if you will, is when they make this mutation in mice, they do the same thing. So if they mutate the leptin system in a mouse, they start to overeat and you get these huge puffy fur balls of mice.
We're talking about how our genes can kind of predetermine our personality traits and the like with Dr. Bill Sullivan, who is the author of Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. And I'm curious about violent behavior. That's cited as something that DNA can also have a hand in influencing. Does this mean that those born with a violent gene are destined to act violently?
That's a great question. And this is a relatively new science and a new appreciation for how far genes can really affect us. I mean, in hindsight, speaking as someone who works with genetics and genetics traits, it's not terribly surprising to me that genes are going to predispose us towards certain behaviors. But it's also not surprising to me that we can change things in our environment to either short circuit that process or circumvent it in some way. So the primary case that is usually thrown out there as an example happened in 2009 with this fellow named Bradley Waldrop. He was the first person in history to be spared the death penalty because of his genes. And this was kind of a shocker at the time. But his lawyers effectively argued that because he has a mutation in a gene called MAOA, I'll tell you about that in a minute, that he could be exonerated, or at least the sentence would be reduced for his crimes. Because if it's a genetic mutation, then clearly, you know, you don't have control over that. That's just the way you were born. So how this works is that MAOA is an enzyme that clears neurotransmitters in the brain. It breaks them down and gets rid of them. And if you have a defect in that enzyme, these neurotransmitters can build up to a toxic level, which can cause you to lose your ability to impulse control, and it can cause you to be more aggressive, think without acting. So that is what Bradley Waldrop and many other people have this variation. So what sends the statistics through the roof, the odds of you being aggressive, is if you have that mutation and you grew up in an adverse environment where you were exposed to child abuse or bullying or neglect, if you have that combination, then you have a very high probability of suffering rage disorder or being aggressive. And that blows everybody's minds with respect to how we think about people who might bully or people who might be engaging in heinous acts. There's a number of other biological explanations for this that are not just within our genetics, but there's brain issues as well. We've seen in the news very recently with CTE, the concussions that some athletes sustain over time because of contact sports can cause their behavior to change, sometimes in murderous ways. So there's a multitude of different biological explanations for how violence can be a characteristic in someone.
So does that mean that trauma can kind of scar the genetic code?
It does at an epigenetic level. So this goes back to the chemical changes that can take place on DNA as a result of things in the environment. So one of the classic studies that was done not long ago were the study of mice or even children who were abused early in life. So what researchers have found is that this causes the silencing of a gene that clears stress hormones from the body. And there's a sound biological reason for why that would happen in someone who experiences trauma. People and animal models, when they experience trauma, they tend to secrete excess stress hormone all the time. It kind of puts them on edge, makes them alert. You can imagine there would be advantages. If you were in a perpetual stress environment, that would be a reasonably good thing. But it's also really hard on the body and the mind to be making these stress chemicals all the time. So our body has ways to get rid of them, to clean them up. And in individuals exposed to trauma, especially at a young age, their DNA is modified in a way that the system to clear these stress hormones is damaged. And it also predisposes them to being violent later in life. So you're right when you're talking about how DNA can be scarred, but it is done through environmental conditions, not necessarily the genes we were born with.
You even say that DNA can be an indicator of your political affiliations. Is our DNA partisan, or can it be?
It seems that way. There's some really interesting things coming out in terms of how our biology affects our behavior, and then how those personality traits affects the way we vote. So the key gene implicated in this is something called DRD4. This encodes for a dopamine receptor in the brain. And dopamine is one of the key neurotransmitters that governs our reward response. So it makes us want to do an activity that made us feel good. So this dopamine system is really important in regulating how much activity people like to do. So whether they are risk-taking, whether they seek novelty, how exploratory they are, how unafraid of change they are, relies on the dopamine system. So in our human population, we have all kinds of variations in how we make dopamine and how we respond to it. And you can kind of see this, to put it simply, there's like two different people, ignoring all the ones in the middle. If you look at two different people, some are risk takers and some are not. Some like change, some are afraid of it. And that's how this manifests into our political differences, because liberals are usually the novelty seekers and conservatives are usually the ones who are comfortable with the way things are. So that's one example of how a gene could possibly sway where we lie on the political spectrum. The other genes build our brains. And since genes build our brains and then the environment affect how our brains look, this affects where we lie on the political spectrum. One study that researchers did analyzing brain images, they could end up predicting with about 75% accuracy just from looking at a person's brain scan whether they were a Republican or Democrat.
Fascinating information. Dr. Bill Sullivan, he's the author of Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. Bill, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Up next, we'll hear from another nominee in the nonfiction category of this year's Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards, Melissa Stevenson. She wrote a poignant memoir through the lens of the cars she's had throughout her life. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking with some of the authors on the short list of this year's Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards, specifically the nonfiction category. Right now, we're going to talk with Melissa Stevenson, who wrote the memoir Driven, a white-knuckled ride to heartbreak and back. Melissa Stevenson, welcome to All In.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you tell this story through a very interesting lens. You distinguish these eras of your life, or at least through this story, through the cars you were driving or riding in at the time. Why did you decide to do it that way?
You know, I had tried to tell this story, the story of my brother, his death, growing up with him before that. And I just had great difficulty whenever I would try to write straight to that big story of loss and hurt and grief. I really couldn't quite get the story out. And almost by accident, I realized that in large part, I had been writing about cars as I wrote our story. Our family loved cars, not even fancy cars, just whatever beaters we might have. And then later when I got my first car, that was a wonderful sort of key to independence for me. And then when my brother died, I inherited his car. And so deep into the drafting process of this book, actually, I just kind of had one of those wonderful aha moments when I was working on a segment about our first car, a 1978 Plymouth Volare. And I suddenly started making notes and just kind of traced all our cars from the car my parents got when they were married to the first cars that we grew up with. to my brother's car and my cars. And then I realized that I could use that to structure this much larger, more difficult story.
I mean, you talk about quite a few cars in the book, obviously. We don't need to go through all of them, but maybe we do. Can you just give a quick background on some of the more significant ones featured in the book and why, or rather what they represent in your story?
Yeah, I think you can kind of see, trace through the cars a bit of our socioeconomic status, especially, my parents were teen parents who came from north of Indianapolis around Lebanon and then moved down to Columbus where I grew up. And they were definitely building a better life for us, working really hard. And so they started out with a Mustang, which is in hindsight is a very cool car. But at the time, it was sort of the coolest used car that they could afford. And then there were a couple Volkswagen Squarebacks. It's always good to have a couple Volkswagens because then you can have parts for one car that you get from the other because they're always breaking down. After that's when we bought the Plymouth Valari, and that was a big leap for my family to buy a car, even a basic car like that, new off the lot, was kind of a sign, I think, that we'd arrived economically into a certain middle class, what was middle class then, status. After that, there's some other new cars that my parents bought new off the lot. And then I get into my own teenage series of used cars. You know, the first one, a Toyota Corolla bought for $400. And then I just kind of became the sort of person who never wanted to buy a car that costs more than, maybe a couple thousand dollars when I was older. And I wanted to see how far that could get me. My brother, on the other hand, really liked vintage cars, which I admire. So he had a Ford Econoline van. And then when he passed away, he had a 1979 Ford F-150 truck painted cherry red. It was just a big beast of a car for me. I'd only ever had little four-cylinder engine cars. And so I inherited this car as a way to get his dog. No one wanted his dog back to Texas where I was living. So the rest of the book kind of traces everything that happens to the Ford when I take it after my brother dies. It does, in fact, end up being a little bit haunted, you could say. There were lots of electrical problems we couldn't solve. And at the same time, I had a Volkswagen van. I'm a sucker for Volkswagen still and have a Volkswagen van. And that Volkswagen van was also breaking down. These automobiles I'd relied on for independence were failing me in my grief, and I had to figure it out.
This book is about a lot of things, but some might say that it's ultimately about the loss of your brother. What was he like?
Oh, that's a great question. I really enjoy that question. He was a very big personality, very magnetic, not because he was loud or dominant, but I know it's a cliche, but anyone who's known this kind of person knows why it's a cliche. He was just one of those people that others gravitated to in a room. And, you know, he was kind of very empathetic, very sweet, very gentle, but at the same time, a bit of a wild man. You know, he had tattoos when they were more associated with biker gangs instead of body art that anyone might have. And he had a lot of sort of colorful, interesting friends. So just a real mix of gentle, sweet, but he would do some real outlandish things as well. He was fun. He was great fun to be around when he was feeling well.
Was that he passed away from drug addiction. Was part of his personality, do you think? I don't know. Was it ever alarming to you?
Absolutely. I'm sure many people have had the experience of watching a loved one kind of succumb to addiction. And I'm no specialist, but I would say his case is the case of a lot of people. I think he probably had a certain level of mood disorder that made for that real magnetic personality, the sort of manic ups and then the lows where he would get very down and retreat. And some of the when he was on the edges, maybe coming off a manic, really high, fun time, and then going into a low mode. Every now and then, I just hear a story about how he got intoxicated and tried to pull out his front teeth with pliers, and he'd kind of say it like a joke. And, you know, I was his younger sister. I didn't want to correct him, and I felt very helpless. But I remember thinking, oh, that's not a normal, okay thing to do. And so that cycle of less fun and more alarming behavior really escalated towards the end.
What were his drugs of choice?
I think alcohol was the primary drug. And then later, he definitely lived a sort of rock and roll lifestyle and had been on tour with a rock band as their road manager near the end of his life. He loved live music and was a muse and a patron for so many amazing bands. But along with that, I think the more time he spent around the music crowd, the more he went beyond alcohol. You know, I remember some cocaine references, and I always wondered about both heroin and meth, and he never wanted to tell his little sister that stuff. But I think near the end, it was probably just kind of whatever was around. And he wasn't even addicted to hard drugs in the way that I've seen other people addicted to them. I think he just had so much shame over it. And then alcohol was kind of his main battle.
We're talking to some of the authors on the short list of this year's Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. And right now we're speaking with Melissa Stevenson, who wrote Driven, A White-Knuckled Ride to Heartbreak and Back, which is a memoir. And Melissa, there's obviously a lot in here about substance abuse and mental illness, which I would imagine are primary takeaways from the book for readers. What have you learned about living around that and seeing it happen to people?
You can't save them, in short. And I think writing the book was, for me, was a way of reckoning with that. Watching someone succumb to addiction can be so hard, especially when you're a smart person and you really see it happening. You have that moment where you think, oh, it's not normal to pull out your teeth with pliers. And in hindsight, maybe that's when you have an intervention. Maybe that's when you insist this person gets help. And it's good to help. It's good to express your concern. It's good to be there and be loving. But at the same time, you can't save people. And it took me the entire book, writing the book, to really work that out. I thought about all the different things I could have done. If I'd done X, Y, or Z, would my brother still be alive? If a butterfly flapped its wings on the other side of the world, would he still be alive? And, you know, in the end, all I could do is take care of my own life, be loving and supportive to him as much as I could be in his life. But you can't stop it. You can't save people, and you can't make them better.
How did you try, though? There had to have been ways that you and the family tried to get him help.
Yeah, he wasn't one to ask for help much. I would say I had a very open-minded family that did not lead with anger. So really anything that happened, from some DUIs when he was young and minor possession citations, he would be so hard on himself. And my family was there to help him deal with that. And from the legal details to helping him get car insurance and be able to drive again when he was fit to do so. But just being there, always willing to answer the phone at 2 a.m. if need be, just to talk with him and help him in whatever way was possible. But he died at 29, and in hindsight, that's pretty young. I went through a much more drawn out struggle with alcoholism with my mother, who's passed away. And there are so many more opportunities to get her to rehab facilities and things like that. And he, in hindsight, I see that he hid a lot of his dysfunction, I think, and tried to shield us from that. So it's been 20 years now, and in hindsight, it just seems like it happened so fast that we didn't get as many of the opportunities or didn't recognize them to have the chance to maybe get him some help in the form of rehab or doctors, whatever that might have looked like.
There's a lot in here that involves people who are still with us. Were they mm-hmm. supportive of you telling the story the way you wanted to?
Yeah, that's a real gift that I have, especially as a nonfiction writer. And I know this because I know many nonfiction writers who have entire stories like this that they might want to tell, but they know that it would ruin relationships with people who are currently alive. And not only did I have support, but my relatives were really tickled, I think, or at least made me think that they were, whenever I would ask them for details about stuff that happened maybe before I was born or when I was very young, they were happy to supply those details. And then they just trusted me to go off and make this book, and they did not read it until it was in advanced copies. And at that point, nothing is changeable. And they all read it and just really were delightful in their support of me. And that's a great gift.
Are there any exceptions to that, though? Were there any raised eyebrows or anything like that that made it a little uncomfortable? You don't have to name names or anything, but I'm just curious about that.
Yeah. I did get some funny emails from people who knew my grandmother. My grandmother was I think she was alive when the book came out. Or no, she had passed maybe a year before. And she was quite a character. She's in the book briefly as my grandmother who drove her Buick into the front of a Kentucky Fried Chicken in Lebanon, Indiana. And the newspaper article read that the driver had to be sedated at the scene. She's just kind of a character. And so I was picking up on a lot of the automotive details and putting those in the book. And I think I got some emails from friends of hers saying, you know, I read your book and I loved your book, but I just want you to know that your grandmother loved you very much and the way you write about her. I'm not sure that you know that. And it just kind of made me laugh because I did feel loved by her. I knew that very much, but in the context of the book, it's like, I know, but it's not a book about my grandmother. It's a book about cars. So I had to put the Kentucky Fried Chicken scene in there. It was interesting to get random emails from people that I didn't know, but were somehow connected to the book.
There is a synopsis of your book that's out there that says you know these cars better than you know some of the people closest to you. I don't know if you wrote that or not, but can you expand on that?
No, I've read that too. And I forget where that, that's maybe some of the, publishing materials, I think that can be true sometimes. You see this with people and pets or things they collect and love. Sometimes it's easier to have an extensive knowledge of a thing or an animal than it is to truly connect with the people in front of us. And I'd like to think now that I'm connected to the people close to me in my life, but definitely as a younger person, I think two things went hand in hand. It was easier to know more about cars, and I didn't really have the self-awareness or the interpersonal skills to understand some of the people closest to me. They were real mysteries. My brother was, you know, a central mystery of my life. And also that the way most families talk and the way my family talked, it was easier for us to talk about cars than it was to talk about suicide or addiction or any of those sort of large, difficult topics.
Memoir writing can be painful. It can be cathartic. It can also change your perspective. What did it do for you?
Writing this book definitely had the effect that I didn't expect. I wasn't writing it for this, but I feel like in writing this book, I came out on the other side of the trauma, with it holding less power over me, less negative power. I write about grieving in Texas, and I've never lived in the South, and just the way I write about the landscape is so harsh, as if I'm allergic to the fire ants and the humidity and the heat. But it's that landscape got tied up in my grief, and I felt allergic to the place. I felt trapped in my grief. Right after this book came out, it was actually in August. I visited Texas for the first time in maybe 6 or 7 years, and to promote the book. And I found myself wanting to sit outside when my friends didn't. And that sort of claustrophobic, emotional, traumatic hold that the landscape had on me was gone. I could enjoy it. And I felt that way about so many things in the book, that the last thing to come back near the end of the revisions was the humor and the light and the love and sort of the joyful experiences. So I feel like I got a lot of those back, and they're no longer overshadowed by kind of the shame and guilt and heaviness of suicide and loss.
Are you working on anything else you'd like us to know about?
I'm always writing. I write a lot of essays, and I have a couple books in progress right now. I'm always writing.
Melissa Stevenson is the author of Driven, A White-Knuckled Ride to Heartbreak and Back. It's up for a Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award in the nonfiction category. Melissa, best of luck, and thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Up next, another nominee in the nonfiction category, a biography of J. Irwin Miller, the Cummins executive Martin Luther King Jr. once called the most socially responsible businessman in the country. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking to some of the authors up for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards in the nonfiction category. The winners will be announced on September 1st. Right now we want to welcome the author of J. Irwin Miller, The Shaping of an American Town. It's about the man responsible for turning Cummins into the huge company it is today and making Columbus, Indiana an architectural destination. Nancy Kriplin, thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's delightful to be with you.
So why is it important that we know about J. Irwin Miller?
Well, he's a iconic figure in Indiana history and in business history, really. He had several ideas that were ahead of his time, in my opinion, and he was not only an excellent and very effective CEO of Cummins in Columbus, but he was responsible for turning his little southern Indiana town into one of the iconic and internationally known centers for mid-century modern architecture.
What was Cummins Engine Company, as it was known by then, what was it like before J. Irwin Miller took the helm?
Well, it was a very small company. Cummins himself, Clessie Cummins, was a tenant and a good friend of the Miller family, and he was a pal of Irwin's as Irwin was growing up. Clessie was brilliant, a real mechanical genius, but he didn't go past the eighth grade, I don't believe. So the money for getting his idea of a diesel engine company on the road came from Irwin Miller's great uncle, W.B., and through the early years put up more and more money to try and get Cummins Diesel on its way. And when Irwin came back from studying in Europe, his family brought him back, and he worked for another family company for a while, and then they brought him back to Columbus, and his uncle wanted him to start at the family bank, but Clessie said, no, let's put him there at Cummins. He'll learn very quickly how to run a company like this. And so it was just a small family-owned company that was losing money, and he took it during his years as president and chairman onto being a Fortune 500 company and being listed on the big board. So, you know, it was a very effective time, his 26 years of running Cummins.
How did he do that? He had a lot of different ways of running a company. How did he change it?
Well, and you're right. At first, he said he was dropped in the management, and he had no idea how to do this. So he asked lots of questions. That was always one of his techniques for learning about anything that he wanted to know about. And when you read about how people responded to him in his meetings, you see that he developed a style that was very effective. A 15-minute meeting lasted 15 minutes. And if you went on too long, he would politely cut you off and move on to the next item that was on the agenda. And so he developed a really effective management style. And one of the things that was particularly interesting, because he was, I think, ahead of his time on this, was that in the time when many business leaders, particularly Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago, were saying, you know, responsible management is only interested in making money for shareholders. And that was the very hard-nosed attitude. And Miller didn't believe that. He said there are five important stakeholders in a company, and that is the customer, the employees, the vendors, and of course the stockholders, but most importantly, the community in which the plant is located. And that explains much of his attitude about what he and the company did for this town of Columbus.
Why were those five stakeholders this idea? Why was that an unusual idea for the time?
Well, because so many people believed that what you owed your loyalty to as a businessman was only the shareholders. You had to make money for them, and that was all that mattered. And Miller didn't believe that. He believed that there were other people that had an investment from their lives or from their time in other aspects of the well-being of the company. But it was his particular interest in the community that made him particularly unusual in his time. And I think you see that in many different ways. He could be a hard-nosed businessman. And there was a time when Cummins had to get rid of people because business was down. And when that happened, he called in ministers at various churches in the area for a meeting because he wanted to explain to them why this happened, because he knew that his employees who were affected by this downsizing would be turning to their ministers for counsel during this period. And he wanted to make this as easy a transition as possible.
Of course, he did have this interest in architecture. What did he do on that front? How did that happen?
Yes, well, he, right after the Second World War, when his children were in school and populations increased so rapidly that schools physically were affected. And he did not think these were the sorts of schools that would be producing the kind of education for the children that he thought was important. So he said that one of the Cummins foundations would fund money needed by a name architect who would come in and design schools that would be functional, they'd be effective, and they would attract the kind of employees that he wanted to attract for Cummins, because they could see that their children would get a good education in these schools. So that was all kind of part of one goal. And his actual architectural decisions were based on a series of recommendations that would be put together from a panel of architects. And then he would see which the school board wanted to hire. He tried very hard not to throw his weight around. He tried to be there and support things that the community wanted to do, but he was not the kind of person that said, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. He wanted the community to buy into and be part of all of those decisions. And the first building that got affected by the interest in architecture was the family's church in downtown Columbus. And it was at that point called the Tabernacle Christian Church, Disciples of Christ. And he was able to be part of the group that convinced the Finnish architect Eliel Saarinen to come in and design the church. And it's still one of my favorite buildings in Columbus. It's very simple, very plain. It has a freestanding bell tower And it's very effective, in my opinion. It's now called the First Christian Church. It was built in the 1940s, and that's amazing because, of course, there was a war going on in that period. But they were able to get this church built, and it was, in a way, setting the tone for many of the buildings that would follow. And because of this church, he formed a friendship with the son of Eliel Saarinen, who was called Eero Saarinen, and they had a wonderful friendship through the years, and Eero designed many of the buildings that were part of either the Miller family residences or buildings around the town of Columbus. So it was a very fortuitous meeting of these two young men.
We're talking with Eugene and Marilyn Glick, Indiana Authors Awards nominee, Nancy Kriplin in the category of nonfiction, and we're talking about J. Irwin Miller, The Shaping of an American Town, a biography about the man who led Cummins in the middle part of the 20th century. And he was also involved and interested in civil rights. This is the early 60s we're talking about. I mean, how did he insert himself into the politics of the time?
He was the first layman elected to the very powerful, large National Council of Churches. And when John Kennedy was putting together committees about civil rights, he decided to ask Miller to join this group. And in fact, he put him in charge of the group. And so they had goals of what they were trying to encourage in various cities and towns around the country. And of course, this was a time of great turmoil in the South and in many of the places that were having trouble with relations between the Black and the white communities. And of course, this was a period of the Great March on Washington. And we have had a lot of information recently about John Lewis. And of course, as a young firebrand politician, he was one of the speakers at the March on Washington, and that's where Martin Luther King gave his very famous I Have a Dream speech. One of Miller's daughters told me he was always sorry that he himself hadn't been on the front lines of the March on Washington along with other religious leaders. Apparently, there was concern. Nobody knew whether it would be a peaceful gathering or whether there would be problems, whether his life might be in danger. And so this daughter said he always regretted not being part of that and wished he had gone and taken us, his older children, with him.
Well, he was very much, though, on the front lines of the change of the time. He would shuttle people back and forth from Washington on his airplane, and that's a lot of time in the air. How did he use that time?
Yes, that was a very, very effective. He would lobby for what he thought should be done as far as civil rights legislation. And by the time they landed, they were pretty much convinced. Richard Byrd said, you know, we could have defeated that civil rights legislation if it hadn't been for the church people, because they were not effective or experienced lobbyists, but they would go call on their representatives in Washington, and it made a big difference. And so he was definitely part of the group that helped pass the 1964 Civil Rights Voting Act. And an author named Clay Risen has written about that act. And he said, you know, sometimes Lyndon Johnson's given the credit, and that's true, but there was a whole group of other people who helped get that legislation passed, and Irwin Miller was one of those people.
How did he bring this interest in civil rights back home to the company he ran, Cummins Engine Company?
Well, he would. The company, of course, was easier for him to affect than the community. He worked hard to open up and relax some of the restrictions in the community. And one of the leaders who he brought in to run one of his commissions at and foundations had a lot of trouble finding a house to buy. And so it was a time when there were restrictions on who could buy what. And it was something that was a challenge in Columbus, like it was in many cities in the country in that period. But it worked out, and he brought in other Black employees at non-janitorial levels. And one of the problems they had was finding a barber in Columbus that could cut African-American hair. And so they got together and hired an Indianapolis barber to drive down to Columbus a couple of times a week so they would have a barber that could do a good job with their hair. And so there were a lot of little things like that, and gradually it helped change the attitude in Columbus, as it did in many cities across the Indiana and across the country.
Was that part of his legacy? I mean, did that ever get complicated at that time? I mean, that was at that time, these ideas of integration were sort of just coming to the forefront.
That's right.
How much resistance did he see?
Well, there was quite a bit of resistance, and they were going to vote on some open housing ordinances at a city county meeting, and they called the people who were supporting this, called and said, "Will you come to this meeting? We need your support." And so he went, he spoke, and I think the legislation passed by a vote of 4-3. It was tough going there. And I think that what's interesting right now is that we see many echoes of the problems in what's happening in this country today. And I think, you know, we're not done yet. And I think he made great strides, but it's taken a long time for us to make some of the changes and expansions that we should make. He also was involved. Nelson Mandela came to this country after he had been released, and Cummins and Miller were involved with the committee that greeted him. And Mandela said to this group of CEOs from all over the country, "I'm not asking for a check. I want your whole checkbook." And when Mandela was installed, Zinnia and Irwin were invited to fly to South Africa and be part of this. But at this point, they were not traveling much because they were older. And also in South Africa, Cummins was going to build a plant, but he insisted that they not have apartheid regulations on hiring. And they said, "Well, we're not going to do that." And he said, "Well, we're not going to build our plant." And so he very bravely canceled the plant, and another company from Europe came in and built the plant. But he was willing to stand up for what he believed should happen in this country.
Nancy Kriplin is the author of J. Irwin Miller, The Shaping of an American Town. She's up for a Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award in the nonfiction category. And we will find out if she wins on September the 1st. Nancy Kriplin, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. If you'd like a podcast of this show, you can get it wherever you get podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss a topic you care about. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about misinformation, false claims, and conspiracy theories around the COVID-19 pandemic. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.